First case is 05-1780, State of Ohio versus Kim Cunningham, Mr. Gall.
Good morning, and Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Steve Gall, representing the State of Ohio, and Prosecutor Bill Mason of Cuyahoga County. I would like to reserve 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. I'd like to thank the court for accepting jurisdiction over this very important matter in which the state has appealed the 8th District's holding that the state had no right to appeal the granting of a motion for judicial release. We respectfully ask this court to reverse the 8th District's decision and hold that under Revised Code 2953.08b2, the state has the right to appeal the granting of a judicial release motion. Briefly, in this case, Ms. Cunningham filed a timely judicial release motion after having been imprisoned on a felony 5 offense. She then moved to dismiss that motion, and the court granted that dismissal. Ms. Cunningham then filed a second and untimely motion for judicial release and also asked the court to reinstate her first dismissed motion. The state opposed the second motion as untimely and opposed the resurrection of the first dismissed motion. However, the trial court ultimately entertained the first motion and granted her release. The 8th District's holding, and the majority of the 8th District anyways, concluded that the state had no right to appeal the granting of the judicial release because the legislature has only granted the state the right to appeal in cases of felonies of the first or second degree. And while that makes sense, felonies of the first and or second degree are most serious, and the length of imprisonment is a great period of time. The Court of Appeals, I believe, incorrectly, obviously, ruled on that decision. They incorrectly rely on State versus Kaufman in support of their conclusion. However, State versus Kaufman, we believe, is distinguishable in that, first of all, it involves the defendant's appeal of the decision, not the state's decision.
But counsel, more importantly, the statute itself, 2953.08b, says that you have the right to appeal. The state has the right to appeal.
Correct.
Modification, which is the judicial release section, imposed in any of the following grounds are described in B3, and B3 is specific. It says the sentence is a modification, meaning judicial release, of a sentence imposed for a felony of the first or second degree. Now, if the legislature wanted it to include felonies of the third, fourth, and fifth, it would have said so.
I respectfully suggest that, first of all, 2953.08b is not exclusive. One doesn't exclude the other. It says on any of the following grounds. And under B2, it talks about a decision as contrary to law. As the dissent correctly pointed out in the Court of Appeals decision, if a judge acts contrary to the law, and the example that was given was if there's a felony 3, for example, felony 3 sentence for included mandatory time, either, for example, a drug case or a firearm specification, and if in that case the judge nonetheless grants a judicial release motion, that judge is acting, the trial court is acting contrary to law, notwithstanding the fact that it may be a felony 3, for example, not a felony of the first or second degree. So even though the legislature specifically talks about felonies of the first or second degree in B3, we believe that's appropriate because of the seriousness of the sentence that's a potential there. However, in this situation here, we're talking about a case where the court is acting contrary to law, we believe, as a result of having no jurisdiction to hear the matter.
It doesn't say that the court is acting contrary to law. It says the sentence is contrary to law. What part of the sentence is contrary to law?
When a court, at the point in time when the window, if you will, for filing a judicial release has come.
You're talking on a procedural basis that perhaps the court abused its discretion. But the statute says that the sentence is contrary to law.
And
so if the court would impose some term of incarceration not prescribed by statute, I could agree with you.
Right.
And so what I'm trying to probe with you is, help me to understand what part of the sentence is contrary to law, not what procedural irregularity the court may have engaged in.
2929.20 allows for a modification of a sentence, basically. That modification would be, is part of the sentence. However, 2929.20 prescribes that narrow window of time for when which a sentence can be modified. Once that window, if you will, has closed, the sentence is done. There is no further application or ability to modify the sentence. Therefore,
so if the court had done this before the application had been withdrawn, you'd have no issue.
Well,
you're just questioning the timing of when the court did it.
Not necessarily. Twofold. One is absolutely.
Well, let me ask you the first question then. Do you agree that the trial court could have modified this sentence if it had not been withdrawn?
Yes.
So the court could have done what it did. And your only question then is as to the timing of when the court did it.
No. First of all, if the court, if the original motion was filed timely, and if the court would have entertained that original motion without it being withdrawn or anything subsequent to it, the court would have acted under its authority under 2929.20. However, still, as in this particular case, where the defendant in this case had 15 prior convictions, we would still suggest to this court that there was an abuse of discretion, and under that aspect would be contrary to law. But more specifically, the main point that we're setting forth here is the fact that the court acted without jurisdiction. We still would believe that the court, in granting the judicial release, had abused its discretion or weighed against reasons keeping her incarcerated, outweighed the reasons for letting her release. That would also be contrary to law under 2953.08b2. We think, again, that under the B2 section, it is what you could characterize, what we would characterize as a catch-all phrase. And under those circumstances, again, we talked about the felony 3, for example, mandatory time. If the court acts improperly and gives a judicial release there, or any other such circumstance where the court acts without proper authority, that's given in the statute. 2929.20 also, it's important to note, is a source of relief for the defendant, and the defendant's rights are spelled out within the four corners of the statute. And it's important to note that, again, while 2929.20 doesn't give the state any appellate rights, we believe the appellate rights are given to us in 2953.08b2.
So then, counsel, let me just understand. Your strongest argument is that the judge acted with an abuse of discretion both as to timing and to eligibility of this defendant for this type of benefit.
Yes. And specifically towards the eligibility, the granting of the without the jurisdictional authority. The window, the statute 29.
Well, that goes to the timing.
Exactly.
Of the exercise of this discretion by the judge.
Correct.
And you say outside of the window.
Right.
But you said even if it was within the appropriate timing as dictated by the statute, the prior record of the defendant would have precluded this benefit being given to the defendant.
It would have.
Is that right?
Yes, it would have.
And let me just ask you then. However, that would not necessarily be your basis for appeal. That's not an abuse of discretion that would be appropriate for our review. Eligibility, correct?
We would set forth that under that scenario, just the scenario of the eligibility, that 2953.08b2, the contrary to law, the weight, as in this case, the weight against granting the judicial release is so great that B2 would still give us authority to appeal because that decision would be contrary to law.
Counsel, as Justice O'Donnell has stated, B2 talks about the sentence. You would like us to read that to say the sentence or granting of modification of the sentence is contrary to law. I mean, are you not broadening that beyond the language of the statute?
No. The sentence in this case was modified. The sentence was a granting.
But that's the point. The sentence was modified. The sentence itself, the imposition of the sentence, as I read too, being contrary to law, meaning, for example, a felony of the fifth degree or a felony of the second degree was sentenced as if the person was convicted of a felony of the fifth degree. That sentence obviously would be contrary to law. It sounds like you're trying to expand that category to say eligibility for judicial release would be included in the sentence.
Well, no, because the eligibility factors are fairly well set forth in 29-29-20 that you have to have served your appropriate period of time. And Ms. Cunningham otherwise would have been an eligible offender. And she is an eligible offender by virtue of the statute. And therefore, she is able to file, to seek a motion for judicial release. However, again, twofold. In this case, number one, she filed her motion in an untimely fashion, ultimately. And secondarily, even though she was an eligible offender by virtue of the statute, it's still against the weight of the evidence or the weight of her convictions, the granting of the judicial release should not have been granted. And I'll thank you very much at this point. Reserve the rest of my time for argument.
Thank you, Mr. Gall. Mr. Sweeney.
Mr. Chief Justice, may it please the court. My name is Cullen Sweeney. I'm from the Cuyahoga County Public Defender's Office, and I represent the appellee, Kim Cunningham, in this case. Before I go into the bulk of my argument, I do want to point out a misstatement I made in my brief on page 13. I indicated that the trial court had unfettered discretion to grant a judicial release motion upon its own authority, unconstrained by any sort of time constraints. And cited subsection B of the judicial release statute. In fact, the trial court operates under the same time constraints if it were to grant its own motion as the offender themselves under subsection C, and I just wanted to point that out. That's not really germane to the issue before this court, but I thought it bared clarification. The question in this case really is not, does the state have the right to appeal the order of a judicial release in this case, but the question is whether it has an appeal of right or whether it has to seek leave to appeal, that is, whether it has a discretionary appeal. As the appellant.
Well, counsel, I'd like to stop you right there because that's an interesting question that you just asked, and I was looking at that in relation to the interplay between a final appealable order and just the right to appeal. The Court of Appeals ruled here that this was not a final appealable order. So what does it really matter whether you have the right to appeal or leave to appeal if it's not an FAO?
Well, we would take the position that that indeed this is a final order. The Court of Appeals found that this was not a final order. And they went into whether or not there was a substantial right affected. I don't believe that that's necessarily the correct avenue of analysis. And this court is well within its authority to affirm the Court of Appeals on a different ground. And our and what we would suggest is the correct ground is that the state does not have an absolute right of appeal in this case. That it does have an avenue of relief, that is to seek a discretionary appeal if it felt the court acted without jurisdiction. It did not seek that. It's arguing that it has an absolute appeal of right. And as they concede, their appeal of right is a creature of statute. That is, it's narrowly confined to what the legislature specifically and expressly grants them. In this case, they argue under 2953.08b2, they have been given that right. But indeed, that is not the case. If you look at, and this has been noted by several justices so far, if you look at the introductory language to this subsection, it specifically says that the state has the right to appeal essentially a sentence imposed upon an offender or in the circumstances described in B3 of this section, the modification of a sentence. The legislature carefully and intentionally distinguished between modifications to a sentence and the sentence itself and assigned appellate rights on that basis.
Well, let me stop you then, Mr. Sweeney. Is this a modification of a sentence, or is this a sentence?
This is a modification of a sentence.
But the statute says the sentence is a modification under section. So under, as you know, under B3, that's not the language the General Assembly said. The sentence is a modification. So the General Assembly is saying that the modification of the sentence is a sentence in itself, doesn't it? Isn't that what the words say?
That's correct, Your Honor. I guess the important distinction is not between sentence and modification, but between the imposition of the original sentence and a modification to that sentence. And that's what they really distinguish between. And that's a good example. If you look at subsection 3, they specifically say when they are talking about modifications, the sentence is a modification. And they say that in cases involving first and second degree felonies, the state has an absolute right of appeal. But when they talk about what is contrary to law, they don't say the sentence, they simply leave it at the sentence is contrary to law. And and combining that with the introductory language that specifically limits the state's rights of appeal with respect to modifications to sentences to what's set forth in subsection B3, it's clear that B2 does not apply in analyzing the plain language of the statute. And it should be pointed out, I think, that there is a logic to this statute. This is not a case where the legislature perhaps missed something or it leads to a counterintuitive result. There's a parallel appellate structure here. The state has the limited rights to appeal the original imposition of a sentence. For instance, they can appeal under subsection B1, essentially first and second degree felonies, where the sentence imposed was community control sanctions. Similarly, and under B3, they can appeal the decision of a trial court to grant judicial release to someone where prison has already been given. They do not have a right. In this case, indeed, they could not have appealed. Originally, Kim Cunningham, the appellee, got community-controlled sanctions. They could not have appealed that. They don't have an absolute right to appeal the imposition of a sentence of a felony of the fifth degree. Similarly, they don't have an absolute right to appeal the decision to grant judicial release once the court decided originally to impose prison or impose prison in revoking those community-controlled sanctions.
Counsel, what about the argument that this activity by the trial court was not within the appropriate time constraints dictated by statute?
Your Honor, our position is that the court did have the authority to grant the motion because in this case there was a timely filed motion.
Right.
Which the court permitted to be withdrawn, and then essentially granted relief from that judgment, reinstated the original motion, and granted it. It would be our position that the court had both the inherent authority to do that, and also has the authority under Criminal Rule 57 and Civil Rule 60 to grant relief from judgment. In this case, her attorney, indicated that the motion to withdraw was mistakenly filed. So essentially granted relief from the attorney's mistake, reinstated the original motion.
Well, if we get to that point and we decide it based on the appropriateness of the judicial activity on the trial court level with regards to addressing an appropriate motion to modify the sentence
right.
or ask for judicial release, we don't need to go any further, do we?
Well, I think you would need to go further because I think that the threshold question here would be did the Court of Appeals correctly dismiss the state's appeal? If they did, then I think that's the end of the analysis. And so the question is, did they have the right to appeal in the first instance? And do you even have to consider the merits of their argument, which is that this motion for release was untimely filed? It's that first question that I think is most squarely before this court. And if this court were to find, as we suggest, that the only way they could get this issue before the Court of Appeals is to seek leave to appeal under Rule 5, which they did not do, then if you were to agree with that position, then the Court of Appeals correctly dismissed the state's appeal, and there's no need to get to the merits of whether or not this indeed was a timely filed motion for judicial release. And going back to the logic behind the statute, it's important to note that the Ohio Criminal Sentencing Commission specifically in its report to the General Assembly indicated that it was granting very limited appellate rights with respect to sentencing and with respect to judicial releases. And indeed, the reason it was doing that is because it was concerned about overworking essentially courts of appeals and increasing costs, where before, as this court's aware, before Senate Bill 2 worked significant changes to the statute, these types of decisions were confined solely within the discretion of the trial court. There was no ability to appeal shock probation, which is essentially the precursor to judicial release. The commission struck a balance. They said, in the most serious cases, we will give the state an absolute right to appeal. But we don't want to bog up the courts of appeals with all these judicial release motions involving lower level felonies. In those rare instances where there's an important enough issue to warrant a court of appeals to address it, we will give the state the ability to seek a discretionary appeal. And that is indeed what the General Assembly ultimately adopted. Under 2945.67, the state has the right to seek a discretionary appeal of all matters involving criminal cases except the final verdict. So where there's not an express grant of a right to appeal, such as this case, they can seek a discretionary appeal. So I think it's important to point out the logic of the statute, that the state has a remedy if they feel they were aggrieved. They just attempted to take a shortcut, essentially, in this case. And there's a reason that the Court of Appeals would be given the chance to consider this as a discretionary appeal. Before invoking the full costs of briefing and the Court of Appeals' time, they have the chance to review this case, decide whether it merits its attention, and then grant the state leave to appeal. Additionally, if for some reason, and this was pointed out by the Court of Appeals, if for some reason and they may continue to maintain the trial court did not have jurisdiction, the Court of Appeals denies their leave to appeal, they could also seek an extraordinary writ if they felt that that was appropriate.
Well, the writ of prohibition, you argued that, but writ of prohibition wouldn't follow your argument that the trial court did not lack jurisdiction here to do what it did. The writ of prohibition says the court doesn't have jurisdiction to do what it's about to do, and they're...
That's correct, Your Honor. In this case, we would argue that it would not be appropriate because the court indeed had jurisdiction.
So they're left with appellate with Rule 5.
They're left with appellate Rule 5, and additionally, our position is that the court had jurisdiction. So the only issue that they'd have to argue on appeal was that the trial court in some fashion should not have granted, abused its discretion, and should not have granted this release to Kim Cunningham because of her prior convictions. But that's
Abuse of discretion doesn't go to the jurisdiction of a court, though, does it?
It does not.
The court has jurisdiction to do certain things. It has discretion. And abuse of discretion doesn't attack the jurisdiction of the court.
Absolutely not. And that's why we would emphasize that they did not have this right to appeal in this case, because nothing that happened here was a jurisdictional problem.
Well, they're concerned that the General Assembly certainly would not have permitted. The statutes here are they're not examples of clarity, certainly, to go through these, but the sections of statute. But as you know, the state argues that the General Assembly would not have intended to permit trial judges to sort of, with reckless abandon, do all these things and then not have it reviewed by the Courts of Appeals.
Right. I think that's correct. And that is their argument.
Rule 5 your answer to that?
It is my answer. I think what bears emphasis is that this is the only case. They don't cite another case where the trial court acted outside the time in granting a motion for judicial release involving a lower level felony. This is not a situation where trial courts are indeed acting with reckless abandon. To the extent that it happens, and if it did happen here, we maintain it did not, they could have sought a discretionary appeal to remedy that situation. It doesn't require this court to. And I think it would, in order for them to prevail, this court would have to read into subsection B2 language, which the General Assembly intentionally left out. And I think would violate several canons of statutory construction. First of all, we believe that the plain language, although these statutes may not be a model of clarity, with respect to this specific issue, I think it is clear that the legislature intended to distinguish between modifications to sentences and the imposition of sentences, and with respect to modifications, only gave the state an appeal of right with respect to first and second degree felonies. However, if this court were to feel the need or to find the statute was somehow ambiguous, the state's suggested interpretation violates statutes of construction, in particular, one noted by the Court of Appeals, expressio unius est exclusio alterius, which is that the General Assembly specifically granted them the right to appeal first and second degree felonies. And implicit in that was their decision not to give them the absolute right to appeal in cases involving lower level felonies. It would also require this court to read sentence differently, the word sentence differently throughout the statute. When the General Assembly meant to include modification, they said modification. They don't, in with respect to the section that the state relies on, they say the sentence is contrary to law. There is no reference to a modification. Ultimately, we think that the state is asking for this court to ignore the plain language of the statute, asking for this court to grant it an absolute right of appeal when there is none. The General Assembly carefully considered these issues, granted the state absolute rights to appeal in cases only involving first and second degree felonies.
Does a trial judge have the ability to waive the time period for filing a motion seeking judicial release, in your view?
I don't believe it does. I do think they do have the authority, this case, to grant relief from judgment when a motion...
You're suggesting that the court is bound by the time limit prescribed for filing a motion for judicial release.
Yes. The trial court could grant the motion outside of that time period, but the motion itself would have to be filed within that time period. And I do believe that the court has the authority to grant relief from judgment when they withdraw a motion that was timely.
What was the effect of withdrawing the motion?
The effect of withdrawing the motion was one of two things. It was either the state argues that they have no authority to reinstate the motion under the statute.
Now, the question I want you to answer is, what was the effect of withdrawing the motion?
Well, withdrawing the motion essentially leaves the court without a motion before it. I would say that that's the case. To the extent that the court has the authority to withdraw a motion, which the state suggests it does, it also has the parallel authority to reinstate it to grant her relief from judgment. So I would say that it was withdrawn, that is, the motion was not before the court, but then ultimately reinstated. To the extent that you confine the trial court to what it has express authority to do under the judicial release statute, it only has the authority to do one of three things: to deny a motion, to grant a motion after a hearing, or to deny a motion after a hearing. Those are the only three things it's expressly allowed to do. If you were to decide that it was confined to what it's expressly allowed to do, then I would suggest that the withdrawal of a motion is, in a sense, a denial of a motion, which was timely filed, in which case, the offender could file a subsequent motion that would then be able to be considered outside the time window, and that's provided for in the statute. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sweeney. Mr. Gall, you've saved just about 4 minutes of your time.
I believe the bottom line in this case is that the court acted without jurisdiction. There are several cases, which I believe we cited, Hagen versus Kropp, which is an 8th District appellate case, indicates that a motion to reinstate cannot be used to circumvent the consequences of a failure to file a timely appeal. In State versus Crawford, which is a 1st District Court of Appeals case, again dealing with shock probation, but still indicates that the time periods are mandatory, and after the expiration, the trial court loses jurisdiction over the subject matter and over the person of the defendant. In another 8th District case, State versus Clark, the Court of Appeals in that case reasoned that 29-29-20 bestows limited jurisdiction upon the court to modify a sentence. And then lastly, this court in State versus Suster, which is a 1998 case, 84 Ohio State 3rd at 70, indicates if a court acts without jurisdiction, then any proclamation by that court is void. Bottom line here, there is there's no avenue, nothing here that indicates or it gives the court the ability to act in this case. The motion for judicial release was gone. When that window of time that's prescribed in 29-29-20 came and went, there was no pending motion before the court. There's no way that they can revive it. There's no way they can file a subsequent one. The court acted without jurisdiction. And when a court acts without jurisdiction, any resulting action is contrary to law and therefore is authorized pursuant to 29-5308B2.
Counsel, are you then in response to opposing counsel's argument, I'm presuming you're saying there's an absolute right to appeal and leave of court was not necessary?
Correct.
And is there any circumstances where you would acknowledge that leave of court would be appropriate under the statutory scheme?
Under the scenario given in this case, no. I believe that we have 29-5308B2 gives us that right to appeal right there and then.
As long as there's an allegation of contrary to law.
Correct. And I obviously there needs to be more substance to it and to be looked at on a case-by-case basis. I don't think we can blindly allege a contrary to law argument in any circumstance. But clearly here, under the two.
When the contrary to law is based on jurisdiction, you say that that is your automatic right.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When a court, and I think we all can appreciate that, the court just can't do whatever it's at its whim. And therefore, again, 29-5308B2 gives us that right. The court acted without jurisdiction. The jurisdiction was gone in this case. And we believe that we had the right to appeal. We ask this court to find that the ask that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and find that the state had the right to appeal the granting of the judicial release motion in this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Gall. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion.